Our first speaker is Professor Ross Brownson from Washington University in St. Louis. If I gave an appropriate introduction for each of our speakers, they would not have any time to talk. So I'm going to be brief, and apologies if I leave out any of the most important accomplishments and details. This is a really accomplished group. Ross has been one of the leaders in evidence-based public health, and I think physical activity has been on the forefront of this move towards driving public health practice based on critical systematic review of the evidence, and he will be talking a little bit about that perspective and how it relates to physical activity policy. Our second speaker is Professor Russ Pate, who is a professor in the School of Public Health Department of Exercise at the University of South Carolina and a vice president for research at the university. Russ has been a leader in this field for a long time and was a critical part of the CDC ACSM physical activity recommendation, which kind of changed the rules of the game for physical activity in public health, and right now is chairing a coordinating committee that's working across government, private sector, academic groups, non-governmental organizations to develop a national plan for physical activity. And he'll give us an update on where we are with that. Our last tag team of speakers will be our combination speaker and doorman, Professor Walt Thompson. And Walt has done a lot of things for the American College of Sports Medicine.
Well done.
Yeah, he's been served in a number of leadership roles there. He's a professor at Georgia State University in Atlanta. And Dr. Pam Peek, who is one of the most visible medical leaders in the movement towards for physical activity and greater quality of life. She appears on the Discovery Channel, CNN, Good Morning America, a wide variety of media outlets, and has been a champion for physical activity within the healthcare system and more broadly. So that's our panel of speakers, and I will turn things over to Ross Brownson to lead off.
Oh, good morning, everyone. So mine is sort of the setup to this, talking about these broad environmental policy issues, and then five parts of this that might help us move forward on it. And so the pieces I'm going to talk about on a more brief side, keep in mind, basically each one of these 2 points is about an hour lecture, and so we get 15 minutes, so you'll got 7 minutes on one and 8 on the other. So I'm breaking this down very quickly, and a lot of you in the audience know the backdrop for this. We're going to talk about the broad environmental policy approaches, with the case study example here being physical activity, and then talk about five frontiers or areas that might pique your interest in moving forward. What is the built environment anyway? Let's start with the quote that Tom Frieden used this morning from the World Health Organization. We need to make the healthy choice the easy choice. And in many ways in our society, we've made the healthy choice the difficult choice. And so a lot of what this group will talk about is trying to reframe that argument. For those of you who aren't familiar with this idea of the built environment, there really are two main parts of it. It's land use and it's transportation. The land use might be how we design a city and where the parks go. Are they big mega parks? Are they small pocket parks? How do those connect to neighborhoods? Transportation is travel. You know, where do we invest in roads? Are roads only for cars, or are they also for bikes and pedestrians? And that's sort of the bottom up and the top down. Let me give you also two quotes. So any baseball fans in the group? So you'll know one of the two best baseball movies, Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. And that's a big part of physical activity engineering, if you will. You're trying to build things so people will come. I'd add this quote, if you build it and promote it, they'll come. So building alone is not enough. You reach some population, but doesn't do enough. You ever heard this quote? This is fits well in the Capitol. Laws are like sausages. You know, you kind of sweep it up at the end of the day, and there you go. And so both of those fit. We're trying to build a better built environment, but the political process is messy. Why does it matter? Why might the built environment matter? Well, here's one way of evolution. I've got evolution for physical activity. And so that's one way of thinking about it. And you saw the other slide, I think, already, evolution for our healthy eating. And so you can think about both of these. So this is, you know, this is sort of a joke, but it really isn't a joke, because we have evolved so that these are the sort of default behaviors. And so figuring toward the default behaviors that are healthy is what we're up against. And you all know about the obesity maps, right? Okay? So there's only one obesity map you really need to know. This is too fat, too skinny, so Manhattan and San Diego versus everywhere else. And that's pretty much the story. We don't need all the trends showing us the lines going up over the last 30 years. This pretty much is it. And unfortunately, this is how the BRFSF maps are sort of evolving over time. This, again, is this idea of an activity-friendly community, a place where it's easy to be physically active, either through what we call recreational physical activity or through transportation, even our occupations, even how we put our buildings together and whether we can take the stairs or use an elevator. What are a few of the big trends? Well, has promoted leisure activity work? Not really. We're pretty much flat. I mean, we saw a little improvement, so you'd want to see this line going down. We saw a little improvement there around 2000, 2001, but it's pretty much a flat line going over time, and that's again, recreational physical activity. What has improved is how much, or not improved, but has increased dramatically is how much time we spend in our cars, and this is a measure of transportation people use called VMTs, vehicle miles traveled. Pretty much a trend line that parallels pretty well the physical activity, although this goes back up to 50 years and really sort of starts when we began with interstate highways and sort of moving out of inner cities into the larger suburbia, longer drives. We've got well-designed communities that favor physical activity. In some ways, these aren't Photoshopped. These are real pictures. And so in some ways, you couldn't design an activity makes it more difficult. And I guess a dietitian probably put this in because they're trying to keep you from going to Wendy's. And then this is how our suburbs also can be developed. So you've got nice sidewalks, but they don't really connect up very well. And then this is a debate they're having in Atlanta about will 23 lanes of the highway be enough? And of course, we're not thinking about whether maybe we put a light rail down the middle, or maybe if we put a light rail, we need only 10 lanes of highway. But we're thinking about, you know, only catering to the cars here, not to other forms of transportation. What do we know about interventions? Well, sort of the big picture interventions here are these environmental policy change interventions. And these are designed to change the social political environment. They're really sort of trying to change the social norm about how we think about physical activity and how we orient our lives. So we have good examples, and you heard this well from Tom Frieden this morning about the price of foods affecting consumption and maybe the price of inactivity. If, a good example is if gas costs more, you're less likely to drive a car. Okay. We also know that these are more permanent. If you put a physical structure in place, it's more likely to be there over a longer time. It's not that you don't want to do the individual level social change things, the sort of social cultural things, but those work well with these physical activity. And for policy interventions, this last bullet, a lot of the power is held by the states. Some is held by the federal government. A lot of the action happens at the local level, especially for these built environment issues. So you have to think of it as sort of both a top-down and bottom-up approach when it comes to dealing with the built environment. Okay. Lots of potential, and I think the morning set it up perfectly, the amount of potential we have to change it. And yet, you know, if I hang out with my research nerd friends, if we have to randomize everything and understand things with a randomized design, we'll be here in 15 years talking about whether we have enough evidence. And so we've got to also think about what's the evidence we have, what's the paradox between what we know would probably have the largest impact on health, yet we don't always have the evidence. I'm going to talk more about that in just a minute. And also for those of you who are in the practitioner policy side, a lot of times this takes us out of our comfort zones. It moves us toward issues of advocacy. As I mentioned, the evaluations can be very messy, so they can take a lot of time, hard to randomize, and if you work in governmental public health, you can have limitations on how much you can do and where that fine line sort of comes. And we could maybe talk about some of that in the break. So the next little part is sort of what might be done. And so I've got 5 points that I want to talk about here to segue into the next presentation. The first one is what constitutes acceptable evidence. And this quote I like, "The best is don't let the best be the enemy of the good." That fits well with this idea if we have to understand anything with a sort of biomedical hat, will be here a long time, because policy intervention isn't amenable to biomedical sort of intervention. So we've got to think about things somewhat differently. In a way, what Bill Clinton just talked about set it up perfectly. The second bullet is really the how, that we don't understand the how very well. We might have something that works really well in a research environment, and now we're taking it out to a very disadvantaged community, and we're saying, does the same thing work? And we don't always understand that. That especially affects populations with health disparities that tend to be at lower frequency in the population. And so when you get to a research design, have lower statistical power, less numbers, but also the highest health disparities. We don't understand the interactions across these levels, that we ought to act at multiple levels. And it's not that one level is more important than the other, but we need to do all of these if we're going to have long-term, sustainable, healthy communities. And we even have less information on children. So a lot of the focus of this meeting is on childhood obesity, and yet we don't have all the information we need when it comes to children and childhood obesity. Understanding partnerships and networks. We're not going to get this done by ourselves. We're going to be working with others. We're going to be working across a lot of networks. I put up a slide here, which is going to look sort of mind-boggling, but this is a network analysis that was done in Bogota, Colombia, by Olga Lucia Sarmiento, who's here at the meeting. And what they're looking at here is how networks work together and what sectors are important. And what's important here is the three sectors that are circled, transportation, recreation, culture, and public safety, are all outside of the health sector. Okay, so where in this field where we might have the biggest impact on health are people working outside the health sector. How many of you in this room are outside of the health sector? So that's not enough. So one thing we have to do is broaden our reach to those populations outside the health sector. Same goes with food systems if we're talking about the food side of the equation. So this is a complicated graph, but it illustrates that point, that the health sector ended up, that's that one black dot at number 7. It's kind of by itself. Although it's connected to others, it's not the most important sector that's circled here. Okay? There's the blue as well. We've got to do a better job of applying the evidence we have and that we know. The challenge. So this is a graph. This is actually from clinical medicine for preventive medicine. So what this looks at is the time from when research is done down to when it's implemented. From the time it takes to do a study, publish it, submit it, accept it, publish it, get it into the bibliographic database, get it in some kind of a professional guideline, get it into implementation. So this is kind of a study of studies. And what happens here when you look at this and you sort of add this up is the quote at the bottom. It takes 17 years to get 14% of original research to the benefit of patient care. You think about child obesity, we don't have 17 years to get 14% forward. So we're going to have to do a lot of things that maybe a researcher wouldn't say are ready for prime time that we need to try and evaluate and move forward. And that sets up other things to think about. How do we accelerate that? Well, we use existing systematic reviews like the community guide. We understand what moves towards successful dissemination of results. There's a whole body of work that Ev Rogers started called Diffusion of Innovation. And here's three little points. This D&I is basically just movement of research to practice. It doesn't occur spontaneously. It doesn't just happen in a magic way. The passive approach is just putting out the knowledge. So what Jim Marks talked about this morning is people have good knowledge that the obesity epidemic is there. There's very high media coverage. People know it's there. That alone is not enough to curb the epidemic. We have to do something more active in terms of intervention, especially at the policy and environmental level. And then this idea that single-source prevention messages basically don't work. And a lot of this knowledge we have is from clinical medicine and preventive medicine. We need more practice-based research. So it shouldn't just be research driving practice. It also should be practice driving research. And that evidence ought to be thought of in a robust way that crosses over. Okay? We've got a poster we're presenting tonight. Amy Eiler will be sort of marshaling the poster. We did a survey of 300 practitioners this last few months, and we looked at the issues that were most important to move them forward compared to those that are most available. I won't go through these, but what was striking to me is all the things that were most important, here are the top three, didn't end up on those things that were most available to practitioners. And so we've got to connect up things where they have the skills, the practice and policy community has the skills of things that they really need. And I think what's striking, the top are all policy things, the bottom are none of them are policy things. Okay? So there's another connection. Concept mapping we did a few years back. We did a little project with practitioners where we looked at the various domains that had to hack to move forward the environmental policy movement for physical activity. I won't go through these, but these are the things that and look at how many of these are non-health related, another example, and these are the puzzle pieces that have to happen to make this move forward. This links what practitioners rated as important compared to what researchers rated. And what was striking with this is that little value at the bottom, a correlation of 0.86, which means close to 100% correlation of agreement between researchers and practitioners on the most important issues happening in this area. So we have good agreement. There ought to be a good partnership there to move these issues forward. And then the fifth one, you've heard the quote by Margaret Mead of think globally, act locally. Well, that applies here as well. Three examples, and people who are at this meeting, anyone been to Amsterdam? So in Amsterdam, you see more bikes than you do cars. And so you see bikes really separated with their own roadways from the cars, so it's safe. You know, you're more likely to get run over by a bike than you are by a car in Amsterdam. And so that's a big example. The urban planning in Curitiba, Rodrigo Reyes is here. In Curitiba, even though it's got a fairly high car ownership, 85% of the population use public transportation, the highest in Brazil. It's got 52 meters squared per inhabitant of green space, the second highest rate in Brazil. So the urban planning there in Brazil has really made a difference, and we got to learn from that. And then some of you may have heard of Ciclovia, which in Bogota, they close about 90 kilometers of the big streets in Bogota every Sunday, and for about 4 to 6 hours, people are out getting physical activity. About 1 million people get physical activity there, and Ciclovia is now being applied in other places around the globe, including in the U.S. and Canada. Okay. So I'll leave you with just a few resources. I'm glad to talk more. I'm glad to share the slides. I've got, you know, long versions of anything I talked about here. This is the community guide. The second one is an article we did on this environmental policy research agenda, which is very practitioner-based. The next is our sort of primer on evidence-based public health. And the last is one Mike did about promoting physical activity in the Americas with some attention to these environmental policy issues. We're going to do questions afterwards, right? So thanks.
I really am delighted to be here to have the opportunity to speak with you this morning for a few minutes about the effort to develop a national physical activity plan for the U.S. And Ross's presentation really was a perfect segue to what I'll be speaking about, because I think he laid out very nicely the fundamental premises upon which the effort to develop a national physical activity plan have been based. I have two aims here. The first is to really give you a status report on where we are with the development of a national physical activity plan. And the second is to comment, and it'll be very brief, regarding what I believe and hope should be the relationship between the development of a national physical activity plan and this program, the Weight of the Nation program. I believe there are some very important synergies between the two. I hope we'll exploit those. The background is well known to the people in this room. Just in 2008, we released for the first time physical activity guidelines for Americans, which of course lay out in detail the types and amounts of physical activity that we believe people should do to enhance their health. The guidelines, though, do not go into much detail with regard to how we should change our society to make it easier for people to comply with the guidelines. National plans on a range of health concerns have been undertaken and successfully pursued in this country in a number of other areas. And in a number of other countries, there have been successful efforts to develop and pursue the implementation of national physical activity plans. But in the U.S., we have not, up to this point, had a national physical activity plan, and I think the release of the physical activity guidelines point to just how important it is that we do that. What is a physical activity plan? Well, we think the coordinating committee that's been working on the development of it believes that it should be a formal document that establishes or helps to establish physical activity as a priority public health area, provides a specific plan or framework for action, describes actions that government, non-government, and the private sector will take to promote physical activity in the population. And as Mike mentioned in his introduction, our project thus far has been very much based on a linkage between government, non-government, private sector organizations, and we see it moving forward in that same manner. And we're thinking beyond the development of the plan, and we believe that the plan, once it's released, will not only describe the plan itself, but will also identify accountabilities for partners that would be involved in helping to implement the plan. Our vision, we put quite a bit of time into thinking this through, trying to phrase the idea properly, but our vision is that all Americans will be physically active and they will live, work, and play in environments that facilitate regular physical activity, hence the segue from Ross's presentation, and both parts of that statement were pretty carefully thought through. So I think it's true that the fundamental premises upon which our planning process have been based are very much based in the social ecological mindset. The mission of this project is to develop a national plan for physical activity that works. And you know, I can tell you that everybody on our coordinating committee has got plenty to do in their lives. They're pretty busy. And I don't think any of us had an interest in developing a document that was going to, you know, sort of go into the bowels of a library somewhere. And so even though it's, I think, magnified the undertaking, we have, pursued this from the beginning as an effort that is aimed at producing change, a marked and progressive increase in the percentage of Americans who meet physical activity guidelines throughout their life. We have approached this by drawing together organizational partners. I won't read the whole list, but I will say that I'm delighted by the list of organizations that have come to the table, and they have they've done multiple things, but amongst others, they've placed members on the coordinating committee, and they have provided financial support to help underwrite the effort. And this is the second group of organizations that have committed to the process. I hope this list is going to grow, and it's by no means closed out. So if you are associated with an organization that you think ought to be integrally involved in the development of a national physical activity plan, I'm not hard to find. So please do contact us. Our coordinating committee, again, I won't read the whole list, but a tremendous group of people, most of them representing the national organizations that have come to the table as organizational partners, some people that were involved in initiating the process and have been associated with physical activity and public health issues for a long time. The goals of the National Physical Activity Plan will include making a compelling and urgent case for increasing physical activity in the American population. I think it's a double-edged sword, but I'll editorialize here for just a minute to say that in the physical activity arena, I don't think we have a lot of enemies, at least not many enemies that identify themselves as probably some resistors out there, but I don't think we have many obvious enemies. And I think sometimes that makes it hard for us to get this issue as high on the priority list in public health as the data suggests that it ought to be. And so one of our goals with the National Physical Activity Plan is to help make this case in an urgent manner, that this is truly one of the great public health challenges of this century, and it needs to be attacked as such. Second goal is to provide a clear roadmap for action that will support short and long-term progress in increasing activity in the American population. I think when it's rolls out, I think the National Physical Activity Plan is going to consist primarily of recommendations, policies, practices, initiatives that can be implemented in a 3 to 5 year horizon. So we're not looking 50 years down the road, although we certainly believe that the recommendations that will be in the plan, if implemented, are going to have a long-standing impact. But we're looking for changes that we can make here in the reasonably near future. Another goal is to develop strategies for increasing physical activity in all population subgroups, and certainly to be attentive to the need to reduce disparities across population subgroups. In addition, we'll create a sustained and resourced social movement. It was a little scary, but at our first in-person meeting of the coordinating committee, we came away saying, you know, that this probably we're not going to be successful if this doesn't result in a true social movement. Now, if somebody in this room knows how to start a social movement, I'd like to chat with you here during the break. I'm not sure we know exactly how to make that happen, but I think our coordinating committee strongly believes that that's probably what it's going to take, and we hope that this national plan can contribute to that. Another goal is to develop new and innovative strategies. We hope that in this process some great innovative ideas will come forward and find their way into the national plan, and evaluation is very much a part of our thinking, and by the time we're ready to release the plan, we expect to have a well-thought-out plan for evaluating implementation of the plan as we move forward. We've organized the process around 8 societal sectors. We've considered other alternatives, population subgroups, and so on, and in the end opted for this 8-sector approach. That may not cover the entire waterfront, but we hope it's going to come pretty close. And so what we have done is several things with each of these sectors. One is we've commissioned white papers, and expert authors have drafted background papers on the evidence regarding how physical activity can be promoted through each sector. In addition, we formed working groups that I'll tell you more about here in just a moment. The timeline for this process is as shown here. We started in the second half of 2007. The process was jump-started by colleagues at the CDC, who I think were looking ahead to the release of the physical activity guidelines and felt that it would be important and maybe necessary for us to have a comprehensive national physical activity plan to build out from the guidelines. We've quickly formed a small interim coordinating committee, began approaching the organizational partners that I've already listed for you, had our first in-person meeting in early 2008, and at that meeting we committed to the sector organizational scheme, began planning right away for the launch of the plan and for its long-term implementation, commissioned the white papers around each sector, and committed to a national conference, which took place here in Washington just a couple of weeks ago. We launched a website and went more public with this process just in the early part of this year. We have recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the National Coalition on Promoting Physical Activity, which has agreed to accept responsibility for coordinating a long-term effort to implement the plan once it's released, we hope, in early 2010. We have already conducted the conference just a couple of weeks ago, aiming for launch of the plan in just a few months, probably in the first part of 2010, and then there'll be a sustained implementation effort that will carry on from that point forward. The conference that we held here in Washington just a couple of weeks ago was a working conference attended by about 250 experts from around the country, and we came into that meeting with the recommendations of the white paper authors in each sector, with summaries of national physical activity plans from a number of other countries, and with working group chairs and members identified. We came out of that conference with what I believe will be much of the raw material that will ultimately end up in the national plan. Much of the time was dedicated to working group planning meetings. and each of those groups has provided primary recommendations for what they believe should be included in the national plan, and also have indicated their preliminary thinking regarding implementation strategies for the plan. If you'd like to join this effort, I wish you would, and that's how you can get a hold of us. I'll conclude my comments here by just saying a word or two about how I envision the relationship between the Weight of the Nation effort and the National Physical Activity Plan. We certainly have done everything I think we could to link the two and to provide for good communication. Bill Dietz from CDC, who was certainly a prime mover here in developing this effort, was kind enough to come to the National Physical Activity Plan conference, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to be a part of this conference. And so I think the two processes certainly are linked. It is my hope that the product resulting from the National Physical Activity Plan process is seen as informing the Weight of the Nation effort. And I don't mind telling you that I don't think there's going to be a solution to the obesity crisis, epidemic, whatever you want to call it, that doesn't include increasing physical activity in the population. And that's not to say that the dietary side of the issue is not critical as well. But I think we're going to have to increase physical activity to win this battle. And I'd like to think that the National Physical Activity Plan can make a good positive contribution to that effort. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Russ. We're going to transition briefly to a policy update from the American College of Sports Medicine, and it's a slight change from the initial program. Both Dr. Peek and Dr. Thompson are going to speak in this next section.
Well, because we are the American College of Sports Medicine, we do everything in a sportsmanlike way, so we're going to do a relay team here. And that is, I'm going to be covering exercises medicine, and Walt Thompson will be doing the American Fitness Index. I'm very honored to be the spokesperson for the National Exercises Medicine campaign by the American College of Sports Medicine. This is very exciting, and I'm going to give you a very brief look at how this evolved over time and how this segues into everything we talked about this morning. We're all about the how part of this. The what you'll hear about in a second. The cost is something that's being hashed out. But we're very much into the how. And it's very important because, you see, you can't lose weight if you don't move weight. Think about that for a second. And in the discussions this morning, every now and then we're very sensitive to the fact that where did physical activity go? You know, what goes in must come out somehow. And there's something called the energy balance equation. So we're on this end of it. But we honor the entire balance as it is. Very important to look at this. What have we been doing all along? Well, everything starts with a call to action. So in 2006, Bob Salas and the American College of Sports Medicine team convened a group of leaders. And they all sat back and they said, what do we do with this physical activity issue? Is there something here? Where is the how? We understand we have a plethora of information about how good physical activity is for you. What do we do with this? And there was born a call to action, as well as in the next year, 2007, Exercises Medicine as a national campaign. Following that, we become a constant presence on Capitol Hill. I'm here in Washington, D.C. I'm also the chief medical correspondent for Discovery Health Television. I host a couple of their shows, The National Body Challenge and Could You Survive? And so we do all of this here, and then we want to take this out to everyone. So here on the Hill, we want to message this at a different level. And what we've been able to do are the following. We've written a letter to President Obama, and this was in March of this year. And we're trying to work with the healthcare reform tsunami of 1,000 pages or whatever was going on up there right now. And we're trying to make certain that we're an active participant. When we talk about prevention, it's not just nutrition or physical activity. It's got to be both, and we need to have a voice. We were very honored to be able to be participating in the stakeholders meetings. And these are invitee-only meetings on the Hill meeting up in the Senate Finance quarters, and to really talk about what physical activity means to America. Where's the how end of this? We've got the how end of this. We're also working directly with our wonderful colleagues with the National Physical Activity Plan. We just attended and participated actively several weeks ago. And we also have a health policy network. We have brought to bear over 150 organizations that back exactly what we do. And we got to take it real personally here. You start your own health care reform. Where were you this morning? Where are you going to be today? And this is all about taking it grassroots, and we love that. Where? What part of the grass are we talking about? Well, let's just look at this for a moment. What is exercise as medicine? I'll tell you what it is. It's a global initiative now, not just national, but global. It's seeking to make physical activity a vital sign. We talked about vital signs this morning. You heard this from the CDC team. It's not just looking at height and weight and BMI. What's your physical activity level? What is it? We need to understand this. This is data that's golden, it's platinum, it's priceless. And we want to put this in all the electronic medical records so that we bring it to bear. And if you bring it up, you've got to talk about it. A 2007 survey of the American College of Sports Medicine made it very clear, oh my goodness, over two-thirds of people, consumers out there, are basically begging their physicians and their medical care providers in general to talk about physical activity. Tell us what this is about. How does this affect my life? Come on, it's pretty cheap. Slip on a pair of sneakers. Get moving. What's that? Are we saying this? Well, if we're in the medical care profession, you better walk the talk. And it's important because they're looking to us as mentors. This is what this is about. 15 years ago, I was sitting in front of an executive here in Washington in my private practice. And she sat there and said, I've been working 100 hours a week. I haven't seen, you know, my sneakers since dinosaurs ruled the earth. I wouldn't know what physical activity. I don't take care of myself. But I'm here because I'm a wreck. And now I have type 2 diabetes. Help me. And I told her the usual and back and forth and love it with a passion. And then she got a little bit of that glazed-eyed thing when I said, you know, how about, you know, integrating some physical activity? And out of sheer frustration after talking to her for a while, I just picked up my prescription pad and I wrote a prescription. It had her name on it. And then I wrote, well, exactly what I do with cardio and weight training and the rest of it. And then where it said refills, I put the infinity sign. And then I signed it and I handed it to her. And then I thought, what did I just do? And she looked at it and she was, wow, that's kind of interesting. And filed it away. And I met with her about 3 weeks later. And in she came glowing, feeling fantastic. And she said, wow, that was really cool. What was cool? Your prescription. My prescription? And I looked down and she said, no, this one right here. You told me to move. Oh my God. The power of the pad. I was just screwing around with her. I didn't know. But it worked. And here we are, and we're going to make this real. We're really talking about a prescription, an exercise prescription that a medical care provider, allied team, would be able to actually write, sit down and talk about it. We're even talking about, please, reimbursement to allied medical care professionals and physicians to take, what, 5-10 minutes? And say those magic words and at least get a referral to a certified, qualified professional. There starts the network. Remember what they said this morning. It was about a community network. We want to use all the resources, the boys' clubs, the girls' clubs, the schools, everything. This makes us go out there and take responsibility for setting up the network. You don't just flip a card at someone and say, go find some, this exercise. No, we want to know what that is and formalize it. That's what this is all about. And we, in addition, want to be able to go to that place where we can tell everyone how powerful it is to be able to put physical activity in their lives. Finally, I told you it was grassroots advocacy. Well, Bob Salas, our wonderful leader who started this entire process with the American Medical Association and others, you know, has already written a letter to the editor to 200 newspapers. And in that letter, this is what he wrote. In a very real sense, exercise is medicine. Studies repeatedly show that physical activity and exercise can help prevent obesity, cardiovascular disease, etc. Leading a healthier life doesn't mean hitting a treadmill every night or becoming fanatical about exercise. Just walking that 30 minutes. The bottom line, while we trim unnecessary costs to manage better healthcare resources, let's keep in mind the powerful and necessary cost-effective potential of healthy lifestyles. Truly, exercise is medicine, a prescription for better health. And finally, look what we're doing. Our strategies as we put together this exercise is medicine policy framework. Well, we want to make sure this is a public priority. Come on, it is a public priority, and we're going to get it out there and message this. We want to reduce those obvious health disparities. A higher priority on the science. Our executive director, Jim Whitehead, is already meeting with the National Institutes of Health and other great science bodies, saying, come on, we need really excellent science to be able to allow us to explain this in a simple way and also increase the credibility of what we're really saying here. Finally, obviously, we're talking about disease prevention. I don't even need to say that. You want to make physical activity and healthy lifestyle a part of every single patient visit, everywhere. And so I don't care if this is a physical therapist, if this is a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, a physician, it doesn't matter. Way out there, it could be anyone sitting at a wonderful community facility simply saying, hey, we need to talk about this. It's an important part of your life. We're using that physician visit, that patient visit, or the allied healthcare visit as a beautiful golden opportunity to open up the conversation. Increase the value of what this lifestyle counseling is in this system. And that means the value, you know what I'm talking about. Now we get to the cost. We want to be able to get some kind of reimbursement. In an 8-minute visit, trust me, you're not learning a lot. And then finally, how about that referral system? We need a referral system. This is what's so fabulous about meetings like this. We had our wonderful physical activity meeting several weeks ago. Now we have this. This is the time to network, put it together, and start thinking creatively about what those networks actually look like. At the end of the day, this isn't just a call to action. This is something much more special. This is a call to arms and legs. Thank you.
Close this part of the session out with Walt Thompson, who's going to be talking about the American Fitness Index.
The American Fitness Index, funded by the WellPoint Foundation, started about 2 years ago. We launched a pilot program last year of 16 cities, and this year we enlarged that to 50 metropolitan areas. We call them metropolitan statistical areas, because the data we use, the data sets we use, we're basically in metropolitan statistical area format, so we use that format. But what we wanted to do was to create an objective measure of how cities measure up in two different indicators, personal health indicators and the environment. Do you know what was number one? Washington, D.C. was number one. They have a lot of great things going for them, but I can tell you that on a scale of 0 to 100, 100 being an A+, I think Washington was about a 74. Atlanta was number 15 on the list. So what we tried to do is create this objective, valid measure of how cities measured up in those two indicators, personal health indicators and the environmental indicators. Now, we didn't want to just stop there, because the American Fitness Index then would be a list among other lists, and anybody can develop a list. But here's the point. We can develop lists, and it would be just another list. What we've tried to do with the American Fitness Index is reach into the community. You heard President Clinton talk. You heard the other speakers talk about the how. How do we reach out into communities and really make a change? So we've developed two different things. We've developed the Community Action Guide. Now, it's not just another Community Action Guide, but you can take this into your communities and use the information here to talk with leaders in your communities about how to make change. And there's a media advocacy toolkit as well. People often ask us, how do we contact the media? How do we get on television? How do we get on radio? How do we get to the print? Here's some good, really good information. So if you're interested, there is an ACSM call to action. There's a call to action among all of us, whether you're an ACSM member or not. Visit the Exercises Medicine website. Find out how you can make a difference in your community. Go to the American Fitness Index website, download the report, download the Media Advocacy Toolkit, download the community action guide if you don't want to take them back with you today. Or you can go to the activity policy website created by ACSM, and that tells you how you might be able to make a significant impact with your political leaders. Mike, thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to thank all of our speakers, and I have a series of questions that I could pose to this panel, but I think within this audience we have an abundance of experience. We have an awful lot of people who are actively engaged in the how.
Barbara Moore, I'm with Shape of America, and I also work with the Montana Nutrition and Physical Activity Program, which is funded by the CDC. And basically what I'm curious about is, among these tools that you're putting together, is there a tool that's specifically a validated tool that allows us to evaluate the environment of a community? In other words, with respect to physical activity, of course. We currently have something called NEMS, the Nutrition Environment Measures Survey, which allows us to evaluate the environment of a community with respect to nutrition. You can evaluate supermarkets, restaurants, convenience stores. We need a tool like that for physical activity, and my question is, do you have such a tool in these materials that you've put together and have presented this morning?
Basically, there's a series of tools. If they're conducted in community settings, there are usually these environmental audits of some kind. There's some that go to hundreds and hundreds of questions down to four questions. So, you know, practitioners usually want something on the low end. We have one we've done called the Active Neighborhood Checklist. It's one page. And so there's a variety of things. I think some get caught up in trying to measure too many things. A group I'm working with is helping to develop the evaluation for the Robert Wood Johnson Healthy Kids, Healthy Communities Initiative that's going to be funding 50 to 70 communities, some number in there, over the next few months. And so we're trying to develop a set of, sort of a menu of recommended tools that are short enough that, you know, community level grassroots organizations could use them without being stuck in data analysis for the next 3 years.
Yeah, if I could just also refer people to the Active Living Research website. It's a fantastic resource for environmental and policy tools. There's a section on it specifically for tools that lists several dozen tools and also the citations for them. So it's a really good resource for that.
Hi, my name is Adam Becker. I'm with the Consortium to Lower Obesity in Chicago Children. And I have, a two-part question that related to the same thing. In Dr. Frieden's talk, which I thought was really moving and inspirational, in a lot of the neighborhood organizing work that I do in Chicago, when we talk about the environment, it's very easy for neighborhood residents and community organizations to go to the food environment and think about working with corner stores, getting a farmer's market, even doing sort of produce delivery, you know, community-based produce delivery. But when we talk about the built or physical activity environment, they go to strategies that are much more difficult for them to think about because they require, you know, policy changes, they require city council moves, they require zoning. Have you had examples where you've been able to get physical activity and the physical activity environment at the very highest levels of where people are thinking, like Dr. Frieden, and also at the very sort of lowest levels, if you will, at the neighborhood level, and helping people think about environmental change at a very local level?
You know, as I said in my comments, I do think one of our challenges with the physical activity is to build not only the sense of priority that the issue warrants, but to work to build the infrastructure that we do not currently have to support public health efforts around this behavior. Let's face it, we're still the new kids on the block in the public health domain. It was maybe 4 months ago that the American Public Health Association for the first time created a physical activity council. So, you know, we got a long ways to go before we have established the public health infrastructure that it's going to take to move the dial with regard to population physical activity levels. The other side of the issue is, you know, I've never been more optimistic about our ability to achieve that. You know, I think the issue is gaining recognition, and, you know, I think the fact that we're here talking about it this morning is just evidence that the issue is coming to the fore.
Needless to say, I said that physical activity was lacking, and I was a bit disappointed, to say the least, in some of the remarks this morning. However, that being said, in answer to your question, there are endless creative ways to be able to start a grassroots movement. The tipping point in many respects is with, if you're looking at families, with parents. There's a feeling of angst and outrage. Why aren't my kids feeling better, doing better? And to make the association that it's not more computer time that's going to make them a whole individual and healthy, it's going to be a balance of the studies as well as taking care of themselves with physical activity. So what do? You go into each one of the resources that you have in the community. I've worked directly with Rotary. You have no idea how powerful that organization is. You go to Rotary, they'll come up with more money than you've ever seen, and they'll create that angst, and they'll push the tipping point. That's just one small example. And you go to the leaders in the community, wherever they may be, and it could be the head of a bank, it could be someone in the school system, a hero, a heroine, a principal, anywhere. It takes a while to kind of rough up these, you know, where are these people? Scope it out, investigate it. That's the grassroots end of this. That's how you begin to see that level of change. And then with that comes that outrage that pours into the state capitol, into the mayors, in the city councils. I'm already seeing it up here. It's really interesting as we work on the Hill, hand in hand with the American College of Sports Medicine, getting our exercises medicine campaign out there. Earl Blumenauer, you know, the congressman from Oregon, well, I walked out of there with my little bike pin. Why? For 10 years, he's headed up, he founded the bike caucus. Who knew? You know, there's a fitness caucus. Never knew that either. This is so exciting. Find these heroes and heroines and stir them up. That's how you get this going. We do it on television with, you know, the Discovery Channel. We never had families living reality-wise, trying to take care of themselves. Oh, my gosh, we have 1 million people, 1 million families following the program. You know, very simple, all based upon American Heart Association, American College of Sports Medicine guidelines, etc. So the hope is there. The reality is there, too. We're going to try to bring a lot more of this into a public venue so all of you can take these examples and try to replicate them in your own communities.
Just one quick thing, Adam. If I could extrapolate a little, what I took from your question was we need more stories about successes at the grassroots level. There is an effort. Laura Brennan with Transtria is putting together a special issue of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine that now is just about ready to be put to the rest and get ready through the publication process. And it tries to document the experience of Active Living by Design, which has had 25 communities funded, and it's going to really turn those into sort of practice-oriented stories that will try to document a lot of what you've said, because a lot of that just, it doesn't show up in the literature, so you kind of hear it word of mouth, and that's not always that satisfying. So it's a great question.
I'm Sonia Kalmeyer. I'm from the World Health Organization Regional Office for Europe. And I just wanted to follow up also on those comments made. On the one hand, I think we all realize that in terms of the perception and where we are on the political agenda, we're not where nutrition is yet. And it happens time and time again that people speak about nutrition and physical activity, but the examples end up being all from nutrition. It just happens to be that way. So we have to become a stronger voice still. For one example was when the global strategy, the WHO global strategy on diet, physical activity, and health was published. All the news headlines were WHO publishes a nutrition strategy. So it happens right there, and we have to work more on that for sure. In terms of examples of countries that have taken up creating healthy environments for physical activity on a very high level, there are examples. Some of them are from Europe. Norway, for example, mm-hmm. has a planning law that has physical activity integrated fully to be taken into consideration when physical environments are planned. Thanks. Thanks a lot for the great session, by the way.
Hi, I'm Karen Lee, and I'm actually Deputy Director for the Bureau of Chronic Disease Prevention and Control at New York City's Health Department. I think one of the issues... And you know, one of my questions for the panel would be, are there other examples of work like this being done at both the building level and neighborhood and street levels in the country. But before you get to that, one more comment, and that was around nutrition versus physical activity. I think, you know, for example, in our health department, a lot of nutrition initiatives have taken place and come to fruition, and I think probably you were hearing from Tom Frieden based on those initiatives. And I think part of that is because, one, as I think Sonia had said and other folks have said, nutrition does seem to have some type of resonance and a lot of media profile that sometimes physical activity doesn't get. Another is, I think, within health departments, many of the jurisdictions, particularly around the policy level, occur in food. So, for example, restaurants are inspected and under the purview of health codes, whereas often construction and renovations and buildings and streets and neighborhoods don't. And so health departments, when they want to do this kind of work, have to take a little bit of a back seat because, for example, the active design guidelines that we're working on and that will be coming out this fall are actually being led by our Department of Design and Construction, spurred by the health department and in partnership with the health department, but certainly it's not sort of our guidelines per se. So I just wanted to, I guess, make those points and then hear from the panel as well about my question. Thanks.
To answer an earlier question, I'm not certain how to start a social network, a social movement, but I am convinced that it includes a network of professionals. And I just wanted to put a plug in to promote the National Society of Physical Activity Practitioners in Public Health. We are indeed a relatively new kid on the block. But what we are doing is creating a network among those professionals to promote physical activity in public health. And as such, we are sharing resources, we're sharing tools, we're sharing successes and challenges. And of course, as a result of this networking and sharing, basically the capacity building among our professionals, we're also developing an advocacy agenda that will, of course, address the policy and environmental changes that this session is about. Thank you for letting me share that plug. While I'm on that capacity building and the process, we also mentioned that we have developed, in partnership with the American College of Sports Medicine, a physical activity specialist certification that, of course, puts a stamp of approval and raises the bar for the professional development of our physical activity practitioner.
So, a quick comment there. I think Jimmy Newkirk raises a really important point, and that if we are going to deal with problems as big as obesity and chronic disease prevention and physical inactivity, it will require a workforce to carry out those tasks, and it's unrealistic for us to think that we're going to make much progress on this if we can't upgrade the public health and the clinical workforce to include physical activity and public health professionals to much the same degree that we have nutrition professionals who can help us address that side of the problems. I think this is a really important policy issue, and again, big problems require a lot of people working on them, and right now we don't have enough people, and we don't have enough people with the proper certifications and training to get the job done. And this is a nice step in the right direction there.
Hi, my name is Laura Ojeda, and I'm with Leadership for Healthy Communities, which is a national program of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I just wanted to make one comment and ask one question. With regards to the earlier comments about local examples of best practices, I just wanted to promote our Leadership for Healthy Communities Action Toolkit, which we created in partnership with our 11 policymaker organizations who represent elected and appointed officials at the state and at the local level. We have many examples, and it's divided up into two areas. One is on healthy eating, and the other one is on physical activity. Examples on promising practices and policies that are around land use, for example, physical activity in the schools, active transportation, recreation, etc. I brought copies of our executive summary, but if you want to go online, it's at leadershipforhealthycommunities.org. My question, and I apologize, I'm not sure who I'm asking because I was sitting down, so I couldn't see who was speaking, around the survey that was done with practitioners. Just wanted to see if you could elaborate a little bit more on how you define practitioners, and also if you could elaborate a little bit more on the three priority areas. I think two of them were around policies, and one, yeah, I think was around assessing model legislation. Thank you.
Yeah, that was us, and there's a good plug for the poster session tonight, because that'll be presented at a poster session. It's biased toward the health sector, so the main sort of audience for it was the CDC listserv of nutrition and physical activity coordinators, and I think, I don't know how large that is, but it's a pretty large group. We encourage them to share it out with others, and so I think what we're doing is underrepresenting other sectors. The other work I talked about very briefly, the concept mapping that had those puzzle pieces up, that one we were very sure we represented various sectors. We were very systematic about that. And so with both pieces, I think it does illustrate a couple of things, that perhaps the largest progress we can make on this issue is outside of the health sector. And so actually your toolkit is great, because your toolkit really does bridge outside of just thinking about health, because we automatically sort of gravitate toward other people in medicine or other people in healthcare or other people in public health or whatever, are even a sub-discipline of that sometimes. And I think the other part was on those priorities that were identified as important. They're all sort of policy-oriented, and yet, you know, you look at training in schools of public health, you can get a degree in epidemiology and never take a policy class. Mm-hmm. You can get a degree in behavioral science and never take a policy class. So there's a lot of deficits all the way through the system that are almost conspiring to sort of move us back to a biomedical model that isn't working, basically. And that's basically what President Clinton was saying today, too, is and Frieden, you know, even though he did do all nutrition, that bottom level of the things, the biggest impact, are the kinds of things that are in your toolkit and they're on the list that we're paying the least attention to in many ways.
Maybe I'll just second that quickly. I think our experience with the national plan process thus far is very consistent with Ross's comments. While I'm very proud of the organizational partners that have come to the fore to commit to the process, if you scan that list, there are a number of organizations that any of us in the room could name that you wish were there that aren't there yet. And they tend to be from the really the non-traditional domains, where the people in this room would see the connection to the physical activity public health issue, but they may not see it as central to their mission. So I think we've got more work to do to reach out and try to draw those organizations in, because they really, I think, do have a huge impact on policy that ultimately impacts physical activity behavior in the population.
Hello, my name is Harry McWilliam from an organisation called MEND, based in the UK. I just wanted to give you a little bit of cheer, because thank you very much for a very informative session, and in many ways a very inspirational session, but you seem a little bit downbeat about the role of physical activity compared to nutrition, and you call yourselves New Kids on the Block and all that sort of stuff. In the UK, just a couple of things that might help. We've recently had someone join our organisation who is quite senior at an organisation called Sport England, which is the one of the government bodies or semi-government bodies charged with increasing physical activity across the country. And he said that whilst there was a very simple policy and a very simple target for physical activity, there was a much more complicated nature of a debate around nutrition. And so it's going to take an awful lot longer to fix it, because physical activity in the UK is by no means fixed, a long way from it. But there are some very simple targets, particularly around levels of physical activity in schools and also for adults. And what they did was to put a very small amount of funding in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the how, into creating a network of what are called partnership development managers, who sit across high schools, I guess is the term here, and networks then of junior and middle schools below them, the feeder schools. And they make sure that all the physical activity opportunities in those schools are coordinated and linked and networked also into the local community outside the school. So it's not just a school thing, it's also helping the communities leverage the assets they have at the heart of the community in the form of schools and any form of physical activity that they can provide. And outside that, in the sporting world, they've had a similar network of people called county sports partnerships or county sports partnership coordinators. And so you've only got about 40 or 50 of these things around the country. Need a few more here, it's a bit bigger. But those people can actually create linkages and the networks in a very practical way. And it's a small network of people and a small cost to follow on from the excellent lobbying work that you're doing on the Hill, and actually turn that lobbying and the targets that it will produce into reality in a very, very short space of time. They spent a huge amount of money on things like the Foresight Modelling Report to look at obesity as a whole and and the issues around nutrition and everything else, and they've made almost very little dents in that by comparison. So you might think you're further behind, you're the new kids on the block, but you've got a lot of existing assets and you can leverage those very, very quickly with a very small additional investment.
Thank you for bringing us back on a positive note. I think that the time has never been better for physical activity.
Hi, I'm Christine Fry. I'm from the National Policy and Legal Analysis Network to Prevent Childhood Obesity, or NPLAN. And we work with communities around the country to implement policies both on the nutrition and physical activity sides by developing model policies such as model joint use agreements, model physical activity standards for child care settings, and so on. And we are very interested in evidence-based policy ideas on both sides of the energy balance. So my question is for Ross about your comment that there's a mismatch between the methods which were mostly developed for biomedical research and the subjects of the research in physical activity. And I feel like that could be perceived as advocating for lowering research standards. So I'm wondering what can be done.
We ran into this example with the community guide chapter on urban planning and policy, where you look at the evidence and it's almost all cross-sectional. So you sort of take a snapshot of a community, you look at one urban design compared to another, and it looks like there's big differences in, you know, rate of use of transport, walking for transport or other increase. And we ended up making a recommendation. So I think what you have to do is, and the problem is severe in some study sections who fund these projects, is to get people to think about what's the best design possible for the question being asked. And for policy, you know, you really very seldom can you randomize. Policymakers don't like to be randomized. And if you randomize them, they wouldn't do what you ask them to do anyway. So you might as well not try. And so the idea of natural experiments has gained in prominence. Still hard to get through some of the funding committees, but I think you can make that case, and you know, you come up with the right research terms like a quasi-experimental design, which sounds really good, and describe why you need to do that and explain it, and usually you can get those through. But it does move away from sort of the typical biomedical model, how we understand pharmaceuticals or surgical procedures, which are largely done through randomized trials that you just can't do for the kinds of questions that 90% of the questions we're talking about here can't be answered that way.
Thank you all for being here, and please join me in thanking our excellent presenters.